From national news in D.C.
to behind-the-scenes coverage of the Nebraska Capitol,
this is your Capitol Connection.
And now, bringing the Capitol to you,
here's your host, Nate Graz.
Judge Amy Coney Barrett confirmed to the United States Supreme Court. We'll talk about why this is a victory that should be celebrated. Plus, hear about the importance of developing a biblical worldview and voting as Christians, and why Christians must continue engaging in culture after Election Day. We'll get to all of this and more on this week's Capitol Connection. As always, we are broadcasting from the Nebraska Family Alliance Studio in Lincoln, now just days away from the 2020 election, which is shaping up to be the most important election in our lifetime. And of course, happening in the background leading up to Election Day has been the nomination and subsequent confirmation of Judge, now Justice, Amy Coney Barrett, who has been confirmed and sworn in as a justice for the United States Supreme Court. This is a huge deal, and it is certainly a victory that should be celebrated, especially amongst conservatives. But it also shouldn't be something that liberals and those on the left are fearful of. And we want to talk about why that is and just how important it is to have true constitutionalists on the United States Supreme Court who are interpreting the law faithfully according to the text of the United States Constitution and not legislating from the bench. Justice Barrett is a pro-life Catholic mother of seven who will be only the fifth woman to serve on the nation's highest court and the first ever with school-aged children. Additionally, she is just the second woman ever confirmed to the Supreme Court with a Republican president. The United States Senate voted to confirm Judge Barrett 52-48. So strictly along party lines, Senator Susan Collins of Maine was the only Republican to vote no. But Judge Barrett is someone who is so obviously qualified. She has tremendous experience and credibility to fulfill the role of a judge faithfully. But it's not just her background and who she is as a person, but what her judicial philosophy is. She clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia, and Judge Barrett has made it clear that her position, her philosophy, is that of what judges are supposed to be, and that is that they interpret the law fairly and impartially according to the Constitution. They do not insert their own policy preferences or their favored policy positions into the decisions that they are making. And that is a good thing for all Americans. It is certainly no stretch to say that liberals have become so entrenched in a worldview and judicial philosophy that is counter to the founding ideals and values of our country and our Constitution and separation of powers, because they have become so attached to a method of enacting their policy preferences through the judicial branch rather than the legislative branch that judicial confirmation hearings have turned into a complete circus and denigrated into embarrassing spectacles every time the nominee is seen as a conservative or even just someone who doesn't hold to the philosophy that judges should be creating new rights or reinterpreting the Constitution to say things that it clearly does not. But hopefully, with the confirmation of Justice Barrett, this experiment of co-opting the courts may hopefully be coming to an end, at least for the near future. Our constitutional republic is set up so that if you want to see your policy preferences enacted into law, you can do that, and you can do it through the legislative process. You can vote for people, representatives, who favor or desire to see those policy preferences enacted into law. A conservative Supreme Court does not mean that conservatives get all of their policy preferences. A conservative Supreme Court just means that you have originalists who determine that within the boundaries set by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that Congress can pass the laws, without worrying that the High Court will reject it. For example, Justice Scalia argued that if the Supreme Court exercised its proper role as a court, there would be less political controversy. To quote Justice Scalia, in my view, when the court is operating properly, when it is not applying its own view of what the Constitution ought to be, but is interpreting the legal text as lawyers do, understanding the meaning of those words and the history behind those words, there is a lot less need for politics to intervene. All of that to say, there's been a lot said about this nomination and a lot of really over-the-top, sky-is-falling rhetoric from the left over Judge Barrett's confirmation to the Supreme Court. But in reality, the worst-case scenario for those who were opposed to this nomination is that they can still pass laws that reflect their policy preferences. And that is how our constitutional republic is designed to work. And as Jim Daly, president of Focus on the Family, writes, Judge Barrett's ascent to the bench is a victory for decency, goodness, and belief in conservative judicial ideals. It should also serve as encouragement to the next generation that right makes might, hard work pays off, and that one's deeply held faith need not be subjugated to secularists who want to erase the foundation of America's guiding principles. It's also an indication that a new, true feminism is rising in America. Women who embrace life, marriage, children, and faith. Judge Barrett is eminently qualified to serve on the Supreme Court, and it appears that our nation will be better for it. We should also not forget, on the eve of the upcoming election, that what this nomination and confirmation of Judge Barrett points to and should serve as a reminder is that elections have serious, long-lasting consequences. Right now, we are living in a time of severe political polarization. And what is sad to see is that the toxic tone and partisan nature of our political system discourages many Christians from studying what the Bible teaches about government and considering how faith should inform one's view of politics and voting. If we are not teaching about the importance of developing a biblical worldview and voting as Christians, we are abandoning a major part of our calling as believers to be salt and light and to love our neighbors. Christians are called to honor God in every area of their lives. Consequently, the good works of believers must include every area of life, including politics, an area with massive implications for Christian evangelism, human flourishing, and the freedom to preach the full gospel. As Christians, we have many reasons to care about our government and the political process. Engaging in politics is not only unavoidable, it is also an opportunity to honor God and to show love to our neighbors because the decisions and policies that are made and implemented by those serving in government have a direct and substantial impact on people's lives, especially those who do not have a voice. Government was God's idea, and we should engage with it in a way that is consistent with its God-ordained purpose, to reward good and to punish and restrain what is evil. And we cannot do this if we are not teaching clearly about what the Bible says, clearly about some of the biggest issues in our country. Just because an issue is perceived as political doesn't mean we should avoid it or not talk about it. Because the question is not, is it political, but is it biblical? We need to be committing to pray for all who are in authority, and leverage our own influence to advance laws, policies, and practices, and to vote for candidates who will support and advance laws, policies, and practices that contribute to the flourishing of our neighbors, and who will stand up for justice and reward what is good and restrain what is evil. This is a pivotal election, and the choices could not be more clear. And at Nebraska Family Alliance, we've put together an issues-based voter guide that you can access and utilize for free and even personalize it to your address to see the candidates that will be on your ballot. And you can get the voter guide at NebraskaVoterGuide.com. You can see where candidates stand on issues like abortion, religious freedom, family values, gambling, marijuana, judicial appointments, and more. If you have not yet cast your ballot, please visit NebraskaVoterGuide.com, get your free personalized voter guide, and vote your values this election. And after Election Day is over and the results come in, we must continue engaging both government and culture. No matter what happens on November 3rd, we cannot just and check out and vacation from political engagement. And before I go any further, we should never put our hope or our confidence, and certainly not our salvation, in any politician or political party. We should always be preaching and promoting the gospel, sharing the good news, loving and serving people in our communities, because we know that it is the gospel that will change people's heart. And that's what our focus should always be on. However, that doesn't mean that we can avoid political engagement and cultural engagement. In fact, it should require our promotion of the gospel and living our lives as believers. It makes it a necessity. We shouldn't make it an idol. We shouldn't get our priorities wrong. But we also can never abandon our society and culture and neighbors to policies and ideas and worldviews that are harmful. As our friends at the Family Research Council remind us, as Christians, we must have a long-term perspective. Our engagement in the public square does not start and stop based on election cycles. Since our political engagement is based on God's commandments and biblical principles, we must keep following these commands and imperatives even when an election is not around the corner. We must continue to pray for elected officials and government leaders. And obviously, we should pray that our leaders will fear God and govern according to biblical principles and put those in positions of authority, surround themselves with people who also know and fear God and will do good. But once the election is over, regardless of who is and is not in office and whether or not they know and fear God or not, we should continue to pray for them. In 1 Timothy chapter 2, Paul urges that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgiving be made for all people, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we may lead a peaceful and quiet life, godly and dignified in every way. As soon as the election is over, we must diligently and continually pray for our elected officials, whether we ourselves voted for them or not. No matter who is elected, we must pray that they would govern justly. And we do this not only for our own benefit, but we do it out of our desire for justice and out of love for our neighbor, knowing that God's way is the best way and most conducive for all humans to flourish. And not only must we be diligent in our prayers for government leaders, we also must be committed to talking about the most pressing and important and relevant political issues of our time and taking a stand for truth and having these discussions with our families, with our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers. Like I talked about earlier, voting, we can do a lot through the voting booth, but it won't help our culture flourish if people are voting contrary to biblical principles and values. We need to be teaching people what a biblical worldview of political engagement and voting looks like, and what a biblical worldview means when it comes to thinking about the issues facing our country, so that when people vote, they are not only voting, but they are voting biblically. We are obligated to seek to restrain evil. And one of the ways we can do this is by voting for candidates whose policies seek to restrain evil and reward good. And in a similar fashion, when the election is over, we must, in our own lives, engage with individuals in our own spheres of influence and conversation to change hearts and minds, and to love and serve people in our own communities and in our own places of employment, through our local church, in our neighborhoods, and in our own homes. No matter who wins this election, there is still a lot of work to be done. And as we continue our engagement post-election, we must keep an eternal perspective. There will be much to discuss and dissect on next week's show when we know, hopefully, the results of the election and where we go from here. But I want to wrap up the show today by once again talking about the gambling initiatives that are on the ballot in Nebraska, initiatives 429, 430, and 431. This is an opportunity that Nebraskans cannot miss, because if these initiatives go through and casinos are legalized across Nebraska, this is something that you can't really come back from. This is something that stands to alter and change the culture and environment in our state for worse. And the amount of money that is being spent promoting these initiatives and telling people to vote yes has been extraordinary. And so we want to make sure that voters have a clear understanding of what these initiatives would actually do, because what they would authorize is unfortunately very different from the plain language that is presented to voters. It's very misleading and deceptive. In fact, when Nebraska's Secretary of State reviewed these initiatives, the Secretary of State is in charge of elections and voting in Nebraska. And when our Secretary of State looked at these initiatives, he concluded that they were so misleading, so deceptive, and so confusing to voters that they shouldn't even be on the ballot. Nevertheless, through legal challenges and now spending millions of dollars on advertising, they are on the ballot. And, you know, one thing that I want to point out, I had the opportunity to do a newspaper interview this past week about the initiatives and why Nebraska Family Alliance is opposed to them. And they also talked to one of the racetrack owners who is supporting these initiatives. And so these proposals would allow racetracks to be turned into casinos. They would be allowed to host any form of gambling at a racetrack. So we would have racetracks that would also be full-blown casinos. The term that proponents like to use is racino, a racetrack casino hybrid, but we know that they really end up being casinos that have a racetrack and not racetracks that have a casino. But what stood out to me from that interview, when I saw the published piece, the racetrack owner himself in the interview, in print, said that he himself is not a big fan, not a big proponent of casinos. And this is really telling, and this is true across the country, and it's true here in Nebraska as well. And something that people need to remember: the biggest proponents of casinos, the operators, the people who would own them, the slot machine makers, the people that promote gambling, those who lobby for it, they don't gamble themselves. So the people who would own and operate the casinos, if these initiatives go through, they're the same ones who have been spending millions of dollars on advertising, telling people that this would be great for Nebraska, that it would be great for your town, that it would be great for your family. But guess what? They don't gamble in casinos themselves. They don't even like casinos themselves. And why is that? Because they know that casinos are damaging. They don't produce anything good. They don't want to lose their money. They're not going to be the ones playing the slot machines on the floor of the casino. They don't want to throw their money away. They don't want their families to be the ones who are losing money relentlessly, draining their savings, throwing their future away, gambling away everything they have at a casino. But they want other people to do that. They want you to lose your money. They want your family to go through the suffering and heartache, just not their own. The people who own it and promote it don't use it themselves. And we should think about why that is. We also need to remember that the initiatives on the ballot, they are literally written by the casino interests for casino interests. They are specifically and intentionally designed to help the casino owners, not everyday Nebraskans. These initiatives, 429, 430, and 431, they allow commercialized gambling operators to establish a monopoly on casinos in Nebraska. And not only that, that's what they accomplished through the constitutional amendment, Initiative 429, to allow racetracks to offer casino gambling, which by extension, and this does not appear on your ballot, under federal law, if a state allows other people to have casino gambling, Native American tribes also must be allowed to have casino gambling. So not only would 429 authorize casinos at racetracks, it also authorizes casinos on tribal land. They also don't tell you that you only need to host one race a year to be a licensed racetrack. So they'll be able to hold one race a year and offer casino gambling 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. But even the the initiatives 430 and 431 that seek to set up regulations and a tax structure, which on its face, that seems like a good thing. We do want them regulated and taxed. But guess what? Again, they were drafted and are being pushed by the people who would own the casinos and who would pay the taxes. So guess what these initiatives do? Well, it turns out the regulatory structure that 430 seeks to put in place for the casinos, it would not be the state legislature who would get to regulate the gambling industry. It would not be local governing bodies or the people of Nebraska. It would instead establish an unelected gambling commission. And who gets to sit on that unelected commission? Members from the gambling industry. So this is a paid unelected pro gambling commission to regulate their own industry. And that's why they're pushing so hard for it. And along the same lines, the tax structure that gets implemented, they also are giving themselves special advantages and tax breaks. For example, the statute that would be enacted if these go through would give casinos a tax exemption from paying sales and use taxes that other businesses have to pay. So we're going to establish a monopoly on casinos. We're going to set up an unelected pro-gambling commission filled with members from the gambling industry to regulate themselves, and then we're going to give them tax breaks and exemptions. These initiatives are a great deal for a few gambling operators and tribal leaders, but they are not a good deal for the people of Nebraska. Every time you expand gambling, you are going to expand the consequences and costs of gambling along with it. We know that casinos create social and economic costs that ruin people's lives, families, businesses, and communities. But it's not the gambling operators who will pay for these harms. It is you, the taxpayer, who must pay. Whatever financial kickback the state expects to receive in our state budget from casino gambling, it will ultimately be paid for through the pain and suffering of individuals and families, and it will never outweigh the costs. And it is the taxpayer, including those who never gamble themselves, who will be forced to foot the bill for the destruction and budget deficits that casinos inevitably leave behind. What we all want is real economic opportunity, and casinos can't provide that because that's not what they're designed to do. Casinos do not generate new wealth. They redistribute wealth without creating it. It's a sterile transfer of money, most often taken from the hands of the poor and financially desperate and put into the pockets of a few wealthy casino operators. 50% of casino gambling revenue is taken from people who are addicted to gambling. Casinos cannot survive without these citizens. And if you just think about this business model, it is a business model that depends on addicts. They require people to lose money relentlessly and to gamble away more than they can afford. It requires suffering. It isn't a side effect. It isn't a consequence that may or may not happen. It's a requirement. And the research on this issue is very clear. Casinos make the majority of their profits from addicted gamblers, and areas with casinos see increases not only in addiction, but in bankruptcies, broken families, and crime, including child neglect, domestic abuse, prostitution, and sex trafficking. We are called to love our neighbor, but the gambling initiatives on the ballot represent the antithesis of that principle. We are not going to lower taxes in Nebraska by draining more money from local economies, by driving people deeper into poverty, by creating more government dependence and welfare, and by increasing addiction, social costs, and destroyed families. These initiatives are designed to help casinos, not Nebraskans, and they amount to a public ripoff. They do not serve the common good. They are not going to lift families up. They are going to drive them down. And I know that for a lot of people, these initiatives on the ballot might look tempting, and that is the lure of gambling, the false promise that you will get something for nothing. But if these initiatives are successful, they will come at a steep price, paid for at the expense of families and the values that we care about, like hard work, honesty, integrity, and family. The house always wins, and in order for the casinos to win, it will be our own citizens who must lose. And that's why we are urging Nebraskans to vote against initiatives 429, 430, and 431. For more information and to stay up to date on the latest news impacting family, freedom, and life, visit NebraskaFamilyAlliance.org. That's all the time we have for this week. I'm your host, Nate Graz, Policy Director for the Nebraska Family Alliance. Hoping you'll join us again next week. Thanks for listening to your Capital Connection.